Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here today. While I'm a big fan of podcasts and audio and may have a bit of a fondness for the written word, there are millions and millions and millions of people around the world whose main sources of information are visual. I'm talking about TV series, documentaries, video, and even though you are listening to this interview right now, you yourself probably aren't averse to watching a dang good documentary on some aspect of the past. I'm certainly not, and I can name a huge number of TV series that made me want to learn more about history or paleontology. If you want to reach people, you have to meet them where they are, and people are watching. Today's guest has made some of the very best of those documentaries about the past. Tim Haines is a screenwriter, producer, and director whose body of work includes the absolutely fantastic series Walking with Dinosaurs, Walking with Beasts, and Walking with Monsters. His wonderful fictional series, Primeval, ran for 5 seasons. Now, Tim has a brand new documentary series coming out on June 11th on NBC called Surviving Earth, which is all about mass extinctions over the past 450 million years. And I absolutely cannot wait to chat with him about it. Tim Haines, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure to be here.
How did you get into making documentary series?
Well, science, I suppose. I was a science journalist for a while, but I think I had an epiphany when I saw Jurassic Park and I thought, oh my God, you know, this thing that I loved when I was a child and always had dinosaur models and everything like that, I can actually make them move and I can actually make them look real. And I imagined a little theropod jumping, trying to catch an insect in the evening. And I thought, no one's seen that before. And yet this technology gives us this. So that's why I decided to make that show.
So your background was in science journalism. How much of a shift was it to go from writing and kind of other standard journalistic tools to making a full TV series? I mean, that much different media to be working in.
Yes, although everything was based on fact. I think, you know, I'd made a number of hours of science programs. They always told stories, but we shifted over. We redid the research, and in grammatical terms, I copied natural history grammar. I used the language of natural history because it just helped people believe in what they were watching. And that gave you a way to tell stories, the powerful alpha and the mother looking after her young and all these sort of things. And we just piggybacked those to tell the stories walking with.
I'm really fascinated by that because storytelling is such a useful and widely applicable skill. But I think the idea of telling stories in which extinct creatures are your protagonists is not necessarily the most straightforward conclusion to draw.
Yeah, and I think that we'd had 170 years of paleontology, which had worked out so much that when people say, how do they know that? The truth is, it was slow and incremental and proving it and experimenting, all that sort of stuff. So we got to a place where people knew a lot about these animals. And the other thing which I absolutely love is trace fossils. I don't know if you've heard about them, but that's when an animal leaves its behavior behind. So you have a footprint or you have sort of two creatures locked in battle or whatever. And I just thought all this just gives us the information we need to bring it alive. And so we wind through our stories, incorporating all the evidence we can. And in truth, that makes it feel like a documentary.
It's something I absolutely love about this because when you get those things, there are these frozen moments and they give you almost like an anchor point that you can build your story around. If you have X thing, then you know you can write a story that leads up to it or that follows from that point. It gives you this hard little anchor in an actual real past that you can work with.
Yeah, I mean, a good example, which is most extraordinary trace fossil, is the claw marks in the sand of a dinosaur swimming. So it's underwater, it just scoops the sand and moves on, and somehow that gets preserved and fossilized. But it then asks the question, so this creature, this two-legged theropod thing, was swimming. How does it swim? Why does it swim? What's it after? Is it island jumping, et cetera, et cetera? And so you're right, from that one point, it demands answers and explanation. So you can't ignore it and say, oh, well, they never went near the water, et cetera, et cetera. You go, right, let's explain how that came about.
You have a background in zoology. Were you always interested in the more distant reaches of the past, or did that interest kind of develop? I mean, you mentioned Jurassic Park, but I assume before that you must have had some interest in extinct animals.
Yeah, well, as a child, you know, Stenek Berrian is an illustrator. I loved his pictures, oil paintings of dinosaurs. I loved any show that had dinosaurs in. But gradually, I realized there's no job in it, as I can see. So I did applied zoology, in fact, which is mostly insects, but became a journalist, started writing about stuff. And as I say, doing stories about science discovery and things like that, it's all great. But when Jurassic Park showed that technology and how flexible it was, you go, well, how about that? At the beginning, we thought we would get 5 minutes of dinosaurs and an hour of plants and insects. I went to ILM and said, how much would it cost? And they quoted so high, we thought, we'll never make that. But I did meet a wonderful, wonderful man. He's called Mike Milne, and he just showed what was possible with this technology. And we zoomed from then on.
You've now been making documentaries of this kind for more than 25 years. You talked about the technology. How has the technology that we have access to now, almost 30 years after you started making the first one of these, how has it changed? Are there different things we can do now? Is it easier, harder? How would you describe that?
Well, one of the reasons for pitching this to NBCU was that I could see there's so much more we could do with the technology. The quality of it is much, much better. We don't need really animatronics anymore because you can get so close and do such great work with water and mud and stuff like that. So that was one reason. The other was that there were new techniques coming along, like Unreal Engine, that can give us landscapes. It was a technique used by Mandalorian to create the deserts around him. And it's been great for Surviving Earth because we could do a proper coal forest, a swamp forest from the Carboniferous, and we can do an Ordovician reef. That's all really convincing. But if you're talking about how things are changing, I have to say, someone about 3 years ago stepped on the accelerator. Now we're having even more stuff. So the way we made this show now, if I were to make it next year, I'd make it slightly differently with AI or incorporating AI into the process, because we still want to be photoreal. And I still want to use the photoreal is putting animals into real plates, into real places. And that still has a texture which is that much more believable than if everything is created.
I'm glad you mentioned the landscapes, because I think one of the things that is hard for people in the present to understand when they're thinking about these very, very distant parts of the past, you kind of assume that the animals are placed in a landscape that looks like one that we would recognize. And that's not the case with ancient landscapes. The plants are entirely different. The insect life is totally different. These really do look like alien times and places, but that's something that you can do now really effectively with those tools that would have been quite difficult back in the day. And it allows you to get the viewer a much more immersive experience.
Yes. I mean, it's not as different as you might think, because by the time the end of the dinosaurs, there were a lot of angiosperms. There were broadleaf trees around, willows. I mean, there were things you would recognize. When I first started it, we deliberately looked. We didn't want grass because there's no grass. And we could get a little closer with the backgrounds. I returned to New Caledonia, which I found such a wonderful environment, both for land and sea, in this series, as I did in Walking With, because I just knew not many people were familiar with those Araucaria, the trees that are there. And therefore, it does seem a bit different. But in the opening program, I actually end up amongst the pine in Utah. So that sort of pine is a very, very old type of tree. And therefore, we thought, and there's no grass between it, because there's no flowers and stuff like that. So the particular story is also a piece where an animal is migrating higher and higher to escape the heat. And so it was a very good environment to use. But you can't get around the fact that the Americans just go, that's my backyard.
I suppose the lucky piece is that, you know, the Mountain West is as empty as it is. For those of us who are here, we know, but most Americans are not spending a lot of time in the vast interior spaces that are around there. It is untrammeled country in many ways. When you're making a production like this, because you're making a whole bunch of episodes, each of them is, it's a pretty astounding series of technical challenges to solve. What does the process look like for you? How do you go from idea to execution?
Well, you start with the research. The idea was to cover 8 different extinction events. There's the so-called Big Five, which are the larger ones, but there's also over 20 smaller extinction events. So we started to research all of these. I then wanted to make sure that each program had a different message. One of the Big Five is very similar to one of the other Big Five, so I only do 4 of the Big Five. I wanted to make sure at the end of it, you were looking at a different mechanism. So whether it's falling sea levels, anoxic seas, carbon dioxide, unstable climates, all of these were different reasons why life got into trouble. And so that was the first point. We then, having selected the 8 different events, you then go out to the researchers. You try to find the experts. And unlike walking with, it wasn't just paleontologists, it's also paleoclimatologists and paleobotanists and people like that. So there were a lot of them to talk to, first of all, and you harvest as much information as you can. And you do tend to get drawn towards big fossil beds because you'd love to talk about anything, but actually you want as much information as possible to start guessing about these creatures. So you're telling a story about a group of creatures at that time that people have found together, and you can build a little bit of an ecosystem and then start to talk about how the climatic changes affected that ecosystem. And so having got all that information in, you're then going to say, well, how do we tell this story? What creatures do we tell this story through? And that's when you get into more storytelling, because you go to yourself, right, so there'll be an alpha male in charge of his family group, and you arrive at that by talking to the experts in synapsids or gorgonopsids or whatever, and they say, well, we think from a few, you know, collections of bones we found, we think they were communal, but we think there were small groups, and probably it was a family group led by a male, we think, not females, and so on and so forth. You bottom it all out. And as you know, a lot of creatures do move higher when things get, they've got evidence, because you drop a certain degrees Fahrenheit every 100 meters you go up. So it's not uncommon for creatures to move higher. And so we decided this was actually quite a good storyline for our hero group. And we follow them as they get higher, and they bump into unfamiliar creatures on the way up. And in the end, they end up on the top, and there's nowhere else to go. And the volcano explodes, etc. And it's sort of like a metaphor for life and animals being cornered by this particular event. And so there are all those ways in which we design the story. And once we have that, then you move into storyboarding, which is the next stage.
That's such a lovely example, because it's a wonderful marriage of the message and the format that you're managing to weave together, the theme you're trying to get across with the basic path that the characters in your story are taking. That's really inspiring to be able to think that you can apply these basic narrative devices to kind of whatever form of evidence you're encountering. Like the idea that there is a story lurking there for you to tell, I find absolutely fascinating.
Yes, and because we don't know everything, we very much take the idea that we don't know whether we're right, but we make damn sure we don't know we're wrong. And so we're not going to start making stuff up for its own sake. But within that area of what we think could be right, there's quite a lot of options. And therefore, everything that happens in those shows could possibly happen, but it was just lined up in such a way to tell this story. And in terms of getting information across, and this is what was so important about our series, which when Walking With first went out, it was on BBC One, which is our prime time channel. And you don't get people watching science programs on BBC One. Surviving Earth is on NBC, which is a very much an entertainment drama channel. And we've got to survive there. And the best way of doing that is making sure that people don't feel they're being shoved full of information all the time, but they absorb it through the story. And so that's always our hope, that you engage with it, you're emotionally connect with the character, but there is a lot you're learning as you go along.
So how do you strike that balance? Are you faced with situations when you're making this show where you feel like there's a binary choice between entertainment and education, or is it a more kind of a complicated weighing of factors for you?
I think if you feel it's binary, something's gone wrong. I would say that the extra challenge we had over Walking With is that this is a show about Earth and life and the relationship. And talking about Earth, you can't pretend it's a fluffy animal sitting in a, it's the planet. So going back to that first program again, as the earthquakes come, it's an opportunity to talk about the nature of this volcanic event, which was phenomenal, producing enough lava to cover America in completely in lava, a kilometer deep. You know, it is a huge event. Those are facts, but I think you're tying it into a evocation of that world. You're trying to make, you've got your characters and you've got their world. And it's an extraordinary world because something really awful is happening. And I think, I hope, that the way we wind between the characters and the event feels seamless and people just ride with it.
Surviving Earth is a series that's all about mass extinctions. You mentioned you're covering four of the five major ones, and then I assume you got four other episodes, so four other kind of mechanisms for this. Do you ever find it difficult to communicate the scale of these kinds of events to a 21st century audience that has, I mean, no meaningful experience of a mass extinction? How do you get across like what it's like for that much of life to just no longer be there?
What I found is that the words you say fall differently on people. As you tell someone about a country covered in a kilometer of lava or whatever, to some people that will, there's no reference, it will mean very little. To others, it will suddenly spark a sort of a feeling as well as knowledge. And that's what you're after. You want to evoke. And I think that within there, there are touch points that different people will suddenly make them go, wow, that is really different. I do think it's difficult for people with no reference point to completely understand it, but you don't need to understand every bit of it. I think there is a way in which you just absorb it. And if there are moments which make you go, wow, that's extraordinary. Was it really like that? Did they really look like that? Was the world like that once? I think then you've hit the mark. So in many ways, there are many points I'm trying to press those buttons, but you might miss half of them.
That's the viewpoint of somebody who's been doing this for a long time, because I think novices, when they're making things, assume that the audience is either going to get it right away or not, that it's a binary either yes or no. And really, it's you can't be sure how much attention your audience is paying at any given point in the proceedings, and you never know which specific thing is going to strike that emotional note. That's really, really interesting.
If you work in TV, you are often jealous of cinema. Because everyone pays, they walk and sit down, and they can't leave until the end. And you therefore have the luxury of their undivided attention, which is great, and that's what cinema is all about. But in television, you are competing increasingly against laptops, mobile phones, everything else. And you can't push it. You can't say, no, stop, listen to this. It's really important. You just have to hope that you're pulling them in all the time. And at some point, they might actually put the mobile phone down and concentrate completely. I don't expect that. I have to say multi-screening is probably standard for most people now. But still, you never know what will fall. And you've just got to work it all the way through the show.
That was actually what I was going to ask you about. Have you noticed changes in audience habits? Do you have to make things differently now in 2026 than you did in the 1990s?
I think good storytelling is eternal. And I think that the way you tell stories, I think, is endlessly interesting. And although people will tell you about three-act plays, inciting incidents, and all those sort of story structures, I think recently, first of all, if you look at gaming, there is new types of storytelling in gaming, which have been very cleverly adopted by one or two people to hold an audience. I do some work in vertical dramas at the moment, which are very, very short attention span, disposable kind of drama entertainment. But actually, it's a really interesting way of telling stories again. You've got 2-minute episodes, 1-minute episodes. You've got to keep people ticking along, coming back to it, going away. It just demands different things of the stories. If you tell the story well, it will work. people will love it. That doesn't stop that person who's just watched a whole vertical drama series on their mobile walking into a cinema and enjoying a 2.5 hour film if it's well made. And so there's always hope in that respect, because they're different forms of entertainment ultimately. And I think that the more you give to it, the more it gives back. And that's why cinema always has this wonderful position. It often affects people a lot more than maybe a mobile drama where you just smile and laugh and forget about it the next day.
It's interesting you mentioned the 2-minute drama. I was trying to explain to a TV writer friend of mine, who he's won some Emmys. He's a very good TV writer. I was trying to explain to him how magical the show Bluey is. Bluey is it's 7-minute episodes, but every 7-minute episode has an A, B, and C plot. It's hard to get an A, B, and C plot into a 22-minute episode of television. Trying to get all three and have it be meaningfully affecting for a wide range of audiences in 7 minutes. You don't think that you're going to watch a 7-minute children's TV series and be exposed to some of the best writing you've ever seen. That makes me optimistic. The idea that quality still has a place.
I think we're all incredibly sophisticated watching stories and taking stories in. And the real artists take the rules and they're plastic with them and they produce new stuff. Plus the fact that people like to hear the same story again, but slightly changed. Hell, detective stories, how many times? And yet people have an unending appetite for it. But they always have to satisfy certain things. And I think when people will just turn off if it's not good enough. And that's becoming an increasing challenge. I completely accept that, because there are so many different stories out there now. This one, I hope, whereas it's quite different to be on NBC, I'm hoping that's a good thing, because it's an audience that maybe has never seen anything like it, or not seen any Walking With or what have you, because they never watched Discovery or whatever, will come to it and go, maybe they don't want to watch football, for instance. Just saying.
One of the hallmarks of your work, and this is true of what I've seen of Surviving Earth and true of the previous programs as well, there is a real empathy in the way that you portray extinct animals and versions of the planet that just don't exist anymore. So how do you get people to care about creatures that look alien, belong to a time that's so distant they can hardly imagine it? How do you get that empathy across?
I think I would love to say it's all my clever doings, but actually I think humans are very, very ready to emote. You put two eyes on a rock and they kind of go, oh, he looks cute. So in many ways, it's a failure if you produce a bunch of characters that no one cares about. I think that they're used to watching natural history, and most people love animals of one kind or another. And when you, especially if you have a pet or whatever, you really transfer emotions to that pet all the time. You're sitting there looking at a cat going, oh, he's so sad at the moment. Cat's just thinking about where his next meal is. But we do that. And therefore, if I'm creating these creatures, people seem very ready to go, oh, how sad, he didn't make it. Just like they want a good story, they want to feel emotionally about it. So they put it out there. And if you don't grasp that and draw them in, then you have failed. But at least it's the audience, first of all, saying, all right, give it a go. I'll see whether I like this. And that's what I hope they do with this. They did in the past, and it would be lovely to see them enjoy this, because it does say some important things as well. It doesn't lecture or anything like that, but it does contextualize how the world is now. And the past does have a lot to tell us about what we're going through. And this is where you can see it. And the encouraging thing is that whatever humans may do or feel, life is incredibly powerful. And it has an absolute iron grip on this planet. And whatever this planet tries to do, it can't shake it off. And I doubt we will. So life is okay. It's just, you know, humans have got to be a little bit more careful.
I just finished writing a book that covers from the Ice Age to the Bronze Age. So one of the reasons I was so interested to chat with you today is because there's a basic kind of fundamental optimism to the idea that life sticks around. And the whole point of my book is that over 10,000 years, a lot of societies have come and gone, but people are here. And I'm not by nature an optimistic person. And so that kind of surprised me when I came up with that. But I'm glad to know that I'm not the only person who's seen some kind of fundamental optimism in the way that you look at the world, that life could be here. That's nice.
I think one way of thinking about the now is to think, if we were in 100 million, 200 million years' time as aliens coming down, we could look back at this Earth and we'd go, well, there have been some tough times, especially during these ice ages. The world must have been awful. How did anything survive? And yet diversity now is greater than it's ever been in Earth's history. Life just goes on becoming more and more varied. Every time a mass extinction comes through and sighs down a whole lot, a group is left behind, and then it multiplies on that. So it means that if you look at the little graph, it sort of takes a dip down and then carries on going up, dips down, goes up. And so it's fine. It's learned to live with a capricious planet. But you see, the way it does that is by losing the odd species. Oh, humans.
What a tiny little blip all of us are in the grand scheme of things. Like you can fit the entirety of even the existence of creatures that are somehow closely related to us. That's this tiny little chunk tacked on to the end. In 100 million years, will anybody even know we were here?
Yes. People's concept of deep time is very, very difficult. And when you say to them, well, most species only live for like 5 million years maximum, life moves on, they sort of think this is disastrous, but actually try and live for 5 million years.
I was originally trained as a historian of the Roman Empire, and there's a great saying about the fall of the Roman Empire that, why did Rome fall? It's not why did Rome fall, it's why did Rome last for 600, 700 years? That's the actual question you're trying to answer, not why the political unit dissolved, not why there was a mass extinction, but my goodness, it's wild that they managed to hang on for as long as they did, because the conditions do not point in the direction of long-term stability.
No, but if you've been doing it for two or three Pax Romana, 200 or 300 years, you think this is it. It's never going to change. When they left Britain, I mean, most British were going, hold on, what's happening? They can't be going, because 400 years of them, you know, extraordinary. Yeah. Have you ever been to Paestum in Italy, which is a whole lot of Doric Greek temples? And you realize that actually the Romans came here as tourists. And here you are another 2,000 years later, and they're still standing there.
One of my favorite things about ancient Egypt is actually the Greek and Roman graffiti on ancient Egyptian monuments, because everybody wants to believe, I think, that they're at the end of something, that everything has to have led to this point, and that the world has to be the way that it is right now. But when you look even a couple thousand years back into the past, much less 65 million or 450 million, things could have taken a lot of different paths. There's absolutely no reason why it had to end up like this, nor is this the end. There will be another mass extinction after this. We are the end of one story, and we're the beginning of another and the midpoint of another one. Well, Tim, this was just an absolute pleasure. The show is Surviving Earth. It is out on NBC on June 11th. Thank you so much for joining me and chatting with me about this. Absolutely fascinating. And go watch Surviving Earth.
Thank you.
Next time on Past Lives, we'll move a long way to the east, where we'll meet another mummy. She was buried around 1800 BC in the hyper-arid Tarim Basin of Xinjiang. We know her as the Princess of Xiaohe. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule. And thanks so much. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. This has been Past Lives.